Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Here at The Guardian, we love podcasts. Not only do we make dozens of award winners ourselves, but we also write about our favourite podcasts from around the world too. Every week, our column Hear Hear, that's here as in hearing and here as in where, comes out filled with recommendations from you, our listeners. We sift through them all to find the hidden gems that the podcasting world has to offer. These podcasts are often small yet mighty productions, which you probably wouldn't find highlighted on your usual podcatchers. So, if you're looking for your next podcast or have one that you want to share with the world, sign up for our weekly Hear Hear newsletter at theguardian.com/podmail and send us an email at podcasts@theguardian.com.
The Guardian.
Hello, this is Brexit Means, The Guardian's regular dispatch from Brexit land. This week, in the second of our occasional series on how different EU27 countries view Brexit, what they make of Britain's decision to leave and why, how they're responding, what they want from a final deal, we're going to be looking at Germany. Now, Germany is a member state, obviously, that weighs perhaps more heavily in the equation than most, not just because of its size and the importance of its role in the EU's decision-making, but also because it's Britain's biggest single trading partner, and because, I'm afraid, we are going to have to go there, of the somewhat exceptional place that Germany occupies in the collective British consciousness. So, with me to discuss this are three veritable experts on the subject. Unlike other programmes, we like experts on Brexit Means. In the studio are Stephanie Bolzen, who's the London correspondent of the German newspaper Die Welt, and Imke Henkel, who's here in London for Die Zeit. And on the line from Berlin is The Guardian's very own bureau chief there, Philip Alterman. Welcome to all of you. Let's begin, shall we, with the decision to leave. Some time ago now, I know, but I think it's important to look at the relationship that Britain and Germany had while Britain was still in the European Union. Not that we've left yet, but we are on the way out. I think it's fair to say that Germany generally tended to see the UK as more of an ally in the EU, a country that was kind of a bit like Germany, not given to flights of integrationist fancy, a fellow realist, a fellow pragmatist. So, Stephanie, can I start with you? Is that a fair picture? Could we say that Germany viewed the actual outcome of the referendum, the decision to leave, with surprise?
Very much so. And I remember being in the Chancellery, so in the Prime Minister's office, in the summer of 2016, and somebody close to Chancellor Merkel told me she was shell-shocked. I mean, she was absolutely devastated about this decision to leave. And that's very much in the Merkel view of the world, of Britain bringing something into the European Union that was a wide horizon, what we call in Germany the Anglo-Saxon attitude, liberal, the historic links to the US, the military power, and also when it came to the budget. Germany and Britain always went hand in hand and made sure that the European Union wouldn't get too much money. Saying this, at the same time, long before the Brexit referendum, there was the fact that Britain was already withdrawing. So Cameron taking out the Tories from the EPP back in 2010 and many other things, there was already a feeling, and that wasn't so much Britain, but the Tory party was taking Britain away from Europe.
Kind of semi-detached status. Yeah.
Absolutely. And maybe that's also a little bit the reason why Germany or the German government wasn't too much putting too much effort into keeping Britain in and giving them a better deal than Cameron got, because they were already drifting out onto the Atlantic.
That's right. Yes, I think it was Xavier Bettel, the Luxembourg Prime Minister, who expressed that idea most neatly, which when he tweeted something like, you know, bloody Brits or words to that effect. You know, when they were in, all they wanted were opt outs. And now they're going to be out and all they want are opt ins. You know, Imke, you wanted to come in. That's your view as well. It was that Germany views the UK's departure with regret.
Yes, overall, I would absolutely agree. There also was a huge regret for all the reasons Stephanie mentioned. But I also would like to stress Germans were increasingly feeling exasperated with Britain. I think you could feel that very much in Brussels, where the British side, and that obviously was mostly the Tory party, were very often seen as the odd ones out. But I also remember that before it all happened, there was already an intense debate trying to explain why Brexit wasn't a good idea. Increasingly, German MPs would come to London and try to explain it. Normally, if MPs come here, they come to the German embassy, they talk off the record. They increasingly came here and spoke on the record, said extraordinary things. And I remember one thing was that Cameron was like a butterfly. He was flying somewhere here, somewhere there. You never quite knew where he was, but what we needed were a line. Which is an extraordinary thing to say for an MP, basically insulting the had hardly any repercussions. It was, and one Times journalist quoted it, and I think that was about it. I think it was the only one who was present. And it was really German politicians trying to shout, watch out, don't do that, it's a bad idea, and not being listened to. And I think that was when it finally happened. Of course, there was a shell shock, there was this really, really regret, really genuine sadness. But I think over the month, and I think that is very much where we are now, the exasperation grew as well. And I think that is whatever you say.
And now you just want it over and done with. Really.
Exactly. Over and done with and never go back there. And I think that is really, that cuts all the illusions Britain is going back or there could be a second referendum. It's not. I think that is just not realistic, also for these reasons.
That's very interesting. Philip, I was going to ask you, I mean, there have been some attempts by some in Germany to either persuade Britain to change its mind or to persuade the EU to give Britain sort of the best deal possible. I mean, does that feeling still linger, do you think? That are there people in Germany who would like Britain to change its mind or think it might?
I think at the beginning, after the vote, there was a sort of long spell of sort of disbelief, felt very unreal. And I think a lot of people thought maybe there's a window for the Brits to change their mind. And I think they wanted to keep that window open for as long as possible. So I think even in the sort of a couple of months after the referendum, there was an interview with Peter Altmaier, and he was still talking sort of very couched language, but he was saying we should give the Brits an opportunity, ihre Entscheidung zu überdenken. To think over their decision.
Right.
And that, I think, was the attitude for quite a long time. And I think a lot of people, I mean, if you talk to people on the street, to an extent, even if you talk to people in Parliament, they sort of think that that may still be a possibility. So I think there's always hope. But on the other hand, I mean, you say, you know, there may be some people who want Brussels to give Britain a good deal.
I think, in particular, there was a sort of a business campaign, wasn't there, or elements of business.
A very small business campaign, I have to say. I was at their launch. There weren't many people there. It's run by former presidents of the German Federation of Industry. That's very prestigious, but they are former presidents. Mm-hmm. One of them was a founding member of the AfD. That doesn't necessarily give them that much clout as the other parties. Yeah. These people have been very quiet. They launched the whole campaign the day after the coalition talks collapsed. So there weren't many people listening on that day. I think that may be a debate in the business community, but it really is very quiet. And I think at the moment, German politics is in a period of
considerable flux and uncertainty. Yes.
And people really have been quite happy not to think too hard about about Brexit and to delegate it to Brussels. I mean, you really don't hear that many people complaining or people who wished that they could have a more active role on shaping the situation, because it's a very difficult situation to shape while Britain is unclear about it.
Britain itself doesn't know what it wants. Exactly. All right. Well, thanks for that. Look, let's move on sort of down the timetable a little bit and look at the sort of Article 50 process, the first phase of that process, which, of course, concluded in December. Now, Germany was instrumental in ensuring that the talks would be phased, that they would be they carried out over two phases. And therefore, that these questions, the first three big questions of the first part of the talks, namely the Irish border, the financial settlement and citizens' rights, all had to be settled before Brexit negotiations could move on to talk about the future relationship. Stephanie, I'd like to ask you, is Berlin satisfied with the outcome of that first phase? I mean, I think it's quite notable that the last week, or maybe it was the week before, the head of the sort of Brexit unit in the German government tweeted a kind of a friendly warning, didn't he? That, you know, sufficient progress meant just that, sufficient progress, not progress complete. Not, you know, the target has not yet been reached. Is Germany worried, do you think, that there are things in that first phase of the talks that are not settled and will come back and cause problems?
Not only in Berlin, they're also worried in Brussels. Mm-hmm. And I've heard that in Brussels when I was there last time, and I was in Berlin at the beginning of this week. They are very worried, but it's not only worried, they are frustrated, because the UK once more is not delivering. There's a lot of open questions left from the phase one agreement, which is not an agreement yet. It is just an overall agreement on the three issues you named. But this still has to get in detail into legal texts. And there's a lot that in Brussels they're waiting from Whitehall to deliver. One thing I would like to mention is that I think it's a bit of an urban legend that it was Germany insisting on the Brits had to pay. All the 27 wanted the Brits to pay. Of course, it's quite an easy headline to say the French and the Germans, they just want the money. Da-da. Everybody wanted the money. I mean, that's why also, obviously, we had this such a strong unity in the first phase of the negotiations, because that was something that the member states agreed on. Our citizens have to have a safe future in Britain, that Britain fulfills its financial commitments. Well, and then Northern Ireland, obviously, is a different story. But in terms of phase one, I think, I mean, I was talking to someone in Berlin on Tuesday this week, and it was a mixture of frustration and real worry, because the clock is ticking and ticking and ticking. And you won't get a transition agreement unless you agree on the withdrawal terms, not even speaking about what we are actually, or what the Brits want to talk about, which is the future framework, which is actually now due in March. So they are so far away. And I mean, it's not funny, but the thing is, how can they at the March Council agree on guidelines for the future framework if London doesn't tell them what they want?
Exactly. Imke, for some time, having seen Britain, as we said, as I said in the beginning, I assume this is the way that Britain was largely perceived, as relatively kind of pragmatic and realistic and sensible. Is there a degree of surprise in Germany at the kind of utter confusion with which the government is approaching Brexit?
Yes, and there certainly is. But now we are moving in a very, very interesting area, the perception of Britain, because I think it has also been wrong for a long, long time, and not least our reporting of us foreign correspondents, or what our editors wanted us to report on, and is partly to blame on it. I think, again, speaking of urban myths, yes, we had this myth of Britain being pragmatic and rational. Mm-hmm. And I think for a long time it has not been so. And interesting, I moved from journalism to academic career, and I starting a research where you actually can find that this kind of intense romanticism and irrational dream of a not modern and sovereign and state goes back really to 200 years in Britain. And you have populist utterances which are quite close to what we have nowadays. Hmm. Coming back to how frustrated Germany really is, and the whole of the EU, and I very much agree there with Stephanie, we're living in cloud cuckoo land. We had the sufficient progress, which, among other things, included this alignment in Ireland. Mm-hmm. The next day, we had the David Davis, the Brexit secretary, saying actually that it wasn't quite what was meant with it. We still discuss about alignment. There's no idea whether this alignment is going to work. This is just one of the areas. We have the Prime Minister going back on any agreement, on any assurance.
Citizens' rights.
Citizens' rights.
Just this week. Yeah.
Just this week, precisely. So we had an agreement, we're moving backwards. Mm. And then the whole economic area, there's no idea where Britain stands. That is complete Glaucoga land. When she was leaked the planning that was pretty detrimental, which is basically saying what people were saying since months or if not years, that moving out of one of the biggest economic areas is not a good idea. Pretty obvious. The reply is, actually, we haven't taken into account there's a unicorn out there, yes, which is our idea. We have a special deal that no one has, that no one apart from us wants.
And which the EU has effectively ruled out.
Which effectively the EU has ruled out, and which we even don't know exactly what it will be. But this one hasn't been taken into account, and that will be marvellous. Yeah. And of course, yes, are other partners frustrated with that view? Yes, they are. And I think that is where we are moving increasingly. If you started saying we had a regret. Yes, we had a regret. But I think this regret is fading very quickly because there's nothing really to hang on to.
Faced with this, exactly. Yes, I think, you know, from my perspective, what we're really seeing here in Britain's approach to Brexit is this kind of unique and deadly British combination of kind of ignorance and arrogance. You know, kind of an ignorance of how the EU works and an arrogance about what it can achieve and its place in the world. Well, that's another word for it. Philip, I'd like to talk a little bit about Germany in the EU and this perception in Britain, at least, that Germany basically kind of runs the show. And it's certainly true that you know, the EU's unity was absolutely striking throughout all of last year, and Germany clearly played an important part in that. But how accurate is that British view that, you know, the EU basically is Germany, perhaps occasionally with a little bit of France, but, you know, Germany is the one that really runs it?
To be fair to Britain, that's a perception that isn't uniquely British. Hmm. That's certainly a complaint you hear from Southern Europe, particularly from Italy as well. I've just come back from a trip to Hungary, and that's certainly what you hear from the people around Orbán as well. They say Germany just thinks about its economy. It's certainly not really what you hear in Germany, partly because there what gets amplified is the decisions at the European level that go against Germany. So interest rates, if Germany was running Europe, I think they would have seized the European Central Bank and they would have very different interest rates. It's a give and take. And I think to sort of sum it up as Germany just running the show is very misleading. And it also misses a much wider historic story, which is Germany is a big country, a big economy that sits in the center of this continent. Now, of course, you could say get rid of the structure and everyone return to nation states, but then you would still have the same arguments that Germany would somehow meddle because it's a big country.
No.
It's like a big elephant that sometimes steps on things.
Right.
We can't get away from, when you talk about Germany, I think to an extent, to say that it's a country which never causes problems. It's that sort of rose-tinted view because it's a big economy that has interests. Like every other country, it tries to have its way. If you look at the statistics of when in Brussels, how often Germany gets outvoted, I think that puts it into perspective.
Okay. Imke, you wanted to have a quick word?
Yes, I would caution a little bit. I think the bridge analysis that Germany runs in Europe is over the top, but I would give it more credence than you do, Philip, actually. I think, and that is partly what is the really sad thing about Britain leaving the EU. There is very rational, very clear-sighted, probably about the best analysis on the EU that is in Europe comes from Britain. And that is the other side to the whole Brexit that we rarely talk about. That Britain really is a divided country in the way there's, on the one hand, we have the Glaucoga land, which is sadly running the country at the moment, but we very much have the rational, very analytical side. And I think they are onto something. And Germany has run Europe, or very much determined what is going on in Europe for quite a while. Remember the Greek crisis, remember the Euro crisis, remember what there happened, which all contributed to Brexit in the end, to not a small percentage. And these are crises which are still not solved and which we are not really talking about.
Yes, the Eurozone, absolutely, is another, yeah. I think we'll steer clear of that one for the time being. But you're right that it did contribute. Let's move on, because I want to tackle a very, very common view here in Britain, which is the fact that since almost the day after the referendum in June 2016, Chancellor Angela Merkel and countless other German officials and political leaders have been among the staunchest defenders of the integrity, I mean, you could almost say the sanctity of the single market, this idea that there can be no benefits without obligations, that the four freedoms must be respected, there can be no cherry picking, that famous term. And since even before the referendum, Brexiteers here have been insisting that Germany will, at the end of the day, end up changing its mind, and it will push for a special bespoke trade deal for the UK because of the immense economic importance of Germany's exports, cars being a particular favourite of people like the Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson. That this is the argument that you could sort of sum up as the BMW argument. Now, Stephanie, can we kind of nail this one once and for all? Can you first of all talk a little bit about the why the preservation of the single market is so important to Germany? I mean, not just sort of the pure economic value of it, but also about the absence of borders, the fluidity of trade, how important it is with German companies that have these massive investments now in Eastern Europe. Why is the single market so important?
I would also call the BMW argument the BMW saga or the BMW urban legend again, because when you talk to German business, of course, there is massive interest because Britain, I think, after the US and France, is the biggest export market. But they have for a long time now made their contingency plans. They are aware of many hundred thousand jobs do depend directly or indirectly of the UK market. But they have more and more been absolutely desperate. They have been coming here. Delegations of business people have come to London and have asked, what do you plan to do? And didn't get any answers. If over month and month you don't get any answers, you look at the alternatives. And this is what they have been doing a lot. And somebody just recently from Berlin said to me, look, if they lose 10% in their business, they lose 10% and they will compensate it somewhere else. Now, the single market, and by the way, I mean, that's the sad element of the history. If you look into the Maastricht Treaty, which is the basis of the single market, it was all driven by Britain. Mm. Also, the freedom of movement principle was driven by Britain. The enlargement was driven by Britain. And it's something that obviously in Germany, because of German history, because of German business history, it was very much welcome. It makes sense. So I come from an area, for example, which is close to the Dutch border and the Belgian border. This has been an area that has been striving. It's the area of Aachen, Maastricht, Düsseldorf. It's an absolutely striving area without borders where you can do business cross border. People can live on both sides of the border. And it just makes sense. And it appeals also, if you go, if you now forget about the economic aspects, for Germany, having been a country that was divided by a wall, not having borders, it's in the collective awareness, the collective memory, and it's something that is an enormous achievement of not having borders anymore. Okay, you will now say, well, it's now at stake again, and Germans are not so happy with Schengen borders or no borders because of the refugee crisis, because of terrorism. But I think the principle of open borders is not put into question, and that is because of business interests, but also because of history and culture.
Mm-hmm. That's a very interesting point.
Yeah, it's a very, very simple, hard-nosed analysis. What do you benefit more from it? Just from a very national German perspective, seeing the single market or trade with Britain, it's a single market. There. So it is actually surprising that these so-called BMW or car argument survives so long. It's obviously wrong. And I would be surprised if there wasn't some analysis within Downing Street because it has become somewhat quiet around this argument. I don't think it's going on anymore.
That is true, yes.
Focus. I think also, if I can just add, the BMW argument, I mean, you don't have to believe that these BMW managers are sort of great federalists or believers in the European project from a sort of utopian point of view. I think they're just very realistic. If you look at how cars are produced these days, I mean, they talk about the long workbench model of car production. When you hear some British politicians talking about BMWs, they seem to sort of still talk about a 1950s idea of how cars are made, that they are all produced in one country and then all shipped across the channel and all sold in the other country. Now it's a really complicated process. And I mean, the cars that eventually may get sold in Britain, they don't just get produced in Germany. They get made from leather that may be tanned in Romania somewhere. So, I mean, there are supply chains that go through the continent. And actually, if you didn't have, I mean, if you are a BMW manager and you don't have free movement, then you don't have, then you can't get your car made.
You don't have BMWs. Open borders.
Yep. Yeah. You don't have your car parts in your factory in time. I mean, it's a pretty realistic assessment of the fact that you need this. This setup in order for your industry to survive.
And that outweighs the, I mean, that seems clear. Can we stay with you, Philip, just for a second and talk about whether Germany sees, I mean, we've talked about potential cost to Germany of Brexit, but a potential gain, perhaps. I know you've reported from Frankfurt on preparations being made there for Brexit. This determination sort of not to allow Britain a special deal on financial services, which obviously, you know, would have potentially at least consequences for the city, the whole issue of financial passporting. Does that play into the equation for Germany? So not just the question of the integrity of the single market, this sort of question of principle, but also, you know, a very practical question, which is that Frankfurt, for example, might gain.
I think it might gain. I would be a bit cautious of exaggerating the gain there. And to be honest, I don't think in political terms it's sort of talked about as a great treasure chest. I don't think, if you talk to people in Frankfurt, no one really thinks that the City of London is going to collapse. That seems pretty speculative, and I think everyone seems to believe that's unlikely. Is there some sort of gain, perhaps even a short-term gain, a little bit of a boost for Frankfurt? Certainly, everyone seems to think that. Frankfurt is already booming anyway. There's lots of banks have been, you know, for the last 5 years, even before Brexit, been opening up headquarters there, or even building new skyscrapers. And there certainly, if you talk to people, they all feel we've been given another little lift by Brexit. So, at one of the international schools I went to, they said, yes, we're going to build 10 new classrooms. Probably we wouldn't have done that if it wasn't for Brexit. So there's a real sort of boost somewhere, but it's limited, and it's not entirely, I mean, even at Frankfurt, it's not always popular. I mean, Frankfurt is already feeling the rise of property rental prices, people being squeezed out of the city centre, long queues for viewings of rental flats. All sounds a bit too familiar from London to be purely just popular.
Yeah, no, good point. Looking at the future trade agreement, if we're assuming we get that far, future relationship, could we identify Germany's red lines in that future relationship? Are they already there and plain to see? Might they conceivably change?
I think there's an illusion in Britain about what can be achieved this year. No one is talking about a trade deal or something that might just look like a trade deal. All we're looking at this year, maybe in October, will be a future framework agreement, which is a purely political agreement where you set up the principle how the future relationship should look like. And of course, there will be a trading relationship. But I don't know what the German benchmarks would be for that, because simply we are too far away from that. Of course, Germany will then introduce its interest of a frictionless trade, as Philip just explained, all this going back and forth for the for example parts of
car parts
or whatever, and that will be a major interest. But I really have the impression that there is not so much thinking about that for the time being, and there is so much delay in the whole Brexit process anyway, that I think there is more worry in Berlin that we won't see a car crash anyway in October, because there is too much still unsolved, which needs to be solved before you can go to the last stage of even get to that point.
To talk about it. Imke, you wanted to?
Yeah, we had recently this fantastic dialogue leaked between Merkel and May, the German Chancellor, and the Prime Minister, and she actually...
I would be very careful about that, by the way. Yeah. I think it's been picked up too easily, and I've been in many backgrounds with Angela Merkel. She would never say it that way. Never. She would never mock another Prime Minister. And just to say, I can imagine that they asked her, so how is it going with Britain, and how is it going with Theresa May? And she just replayed a dialogue she had with Theresa May. And the point is, Merkel didn't mock Theresa May, just the whole situation is comical.
Yes, and I actually agree, maybe not mocking, but I have been in several background briefings with Merkel where she absolutely did make fun of people. But in a very subtle way. And it's not mocking, but she could. I can well see her, because I have heard her doing similar things, that she recounts the conversation.
But simply recounting the conversation is sufficiently
exactly. And the idea is actually not about whether it's funny or not, or whether it's, so the point really is, and I think that the essence will be true, that because that is basically what we're hearing also, that might have made me an offer, and Merkel basically replies, well, you left, you tell us what you want. No, make me an offer. No, you tell us what you want. Because that is basically the situation where we are in. It is still too early, sadly, for red lines or any shape of negotiation to emerge from the European side or the German side, because for that to happen, we need to have a clearer shape of the British negotiation. And the British position still is all over the place. We still have the point where we do not want alignment, we want to leave the single market, we want to leave the customs unions, and on the other hand, people saying, no, actually, and Philip Hammond notably, saying, no, that is not a good idea, we want to stay in, want to keep as much as we want. And this is not something that is resolved, and that is fundamental.
Of course.
And as long as we do not know that.
It's the biggest question, isn't it? Let's move on, because we're starting to run slightly out of time. Philip, I just want to ask you briefly, obviously, the coalition negotiations are ongoing. There's no guarantee how they will end. Even if there is an agreement, it may then be rejected by the SPD members in a vote. Is this uncertainty going to play into the Brexit talks at all in any way, or is Germany's kind of fundamental position basically unchangeable?
At the start of the year, perhaps we would have expected the people who do talk about Brexit in Germany, so, you know, their Brexit sort of working group, there's some people who, you know, have increasingly now talked to me, you would have thought that maybe there would have been lines emerging, some sort of a clearer sense of what Britain may want. That hasn't happened. That could have to do with the fact that there isn't a government, which you can sort of use as, you know, the basis for the decisions that you make. So maybe that explains the standstill. I think perhaps also from a tactical point of view, following on from what we've just said in the group, that it's a bit risky to sort of field your demands when you're sort of unsure whether the person at the other end of the table is still going to be the same one in a few months' time. And we had that situation last year, and it hasn't really gone away. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't really help the negotiations that there still seem to be people, you know, speculating about where the Theresa May one day go. It really, I think it slows down the negotiations, because it becomes a risky exercise if you're too open, or if you show your hand.
And I think it's not only on the level of the prime minister, so on the highest level. I remember last time I was at the council in Brussels, a high minister from a Europe country said, every time I come to Brussels, there's someone else I have to negotiate with, another baroness, another lord, I'm getting really tired of this.
So uncertainty is more on the British side, if anything, than on Germany's absence of a government at the moment. OK, I think there's a bit of an elephant in the room here, which we'd better address. The outgoing German ambassador to London told my colleague Patrick Winter last week that the Brexit vote was in part fuelled by Britain's image of itself in the Second World War. And certainly that kind of sort of jingoistic, nostalgic stuff about empire and Britain saving the continent, in the 1940s and so on, has always influenced the way that many Britons see Germany, even now. I mean, we remember the sort of the two world wars and one World Cup kind of mantra, and has not helped at all by certain sections of the media. How does Germany view that? Stephanie, is it? Yes, I'm sure. Of course, wrongly. But do Germans, Stephanie, do you think, see that many Britons, and or certainly at least let's confine it to the most passionate of the Brexiteers, are basically kind of deluded about this country's place in the 21st century?
I don't think so. I think, but Philip must know that much better talking to Germans when he's out there in Berlin, how they see Britain. Germans see Britain as a very young, cool, innovative country. I mean, they mainly know London, of course. Mm. Then again, if you then read profiles of Jacob Rees-Mogg, again, stereotypes are confirmed. I mean, you can't help it. But I must say, I'm very unhappy about the interview that our ambassador gave, because you can't, on the one hand, complain about stereotypes and then you feed these stereotypes. I think this interview was completely unhelpful, because the right-wing nationalistic media in this country is just waiting for this kind of stuff. And you could see it in the Telegraph and in the Sun. And my worry is, on the long run, because Britain will not get a bad deal, these countries will start exactly that, or are already starting exactly that narrative. Germany, we helped Germany to come back to its feet, and now they are punishing us. And therefore, I'm pretty upset about this interview, I must say.
Okay, Philip, does Germany think Britain's deluded about its place in the world?
I agree with Stephanie on this a little bit. What we've seen sort of for the last week, really feels like we're back in 1996. I mean, you remember there was the Euros, there was the Let's Blitzfritz, Achtung Surrender, front pages. You know, we've gone through a sort of little nostalgic revival of that, with some front pages about some lounges and Germans putting their towels on it, and Telegraph editorials. And,
yes.
I mean, okay, it's tiresome, it's stupid. At the same time, clearly some parts of the British press can't help themselves. And I sort of agree that for the ambassador to bring that up wasn't a smart move. I expect he didn't.
I guess it's no coincidence that he was on his way out.
Yeah. And I think it's a sort of, Germans have their cliches about the Brits, just like the Brits have them about Germans, and I think they should be just as careful about not feeding these cliches too much as the other way around. I think, Brits tend to forget or tend to not realise that actually the majority, the sort of prevailing view that Germany has had of Britain since the Second World War has really been a very positive one, and really a builder of modern Germany. Mm. A lot of institutions were sort of copied and pasted across, whether it's, newspapers like built, modelled on the Daily Mirror, or many, many things. German public life, Britain is regarded as a model, for a long time. And the soft power that really Britain had over Germany, I think, has taken a bit of a knock since June 2016.
Yeah. Fair enough. All right, it's time to wrap up, I'm afraid. I just want to ask you each in turn one very brief final question, which is simply this. It's been about 18 months since the referendum. Where are we going to be in 18 months' time? Soft, hard, car crash, an election in Britain, a second referendum? Stephanie.
I think we're going to be in a muddling through fudge situation. Britain will be out and in a transition period or implementation period, if you prefer, and still will not know what it's going to look like really when you are out.
Okay.
I think everything is possible. A car crash is quite possible because there are fierce contradictions in the British government. And if they are not trying to resolve it, I think Europe absolutely does not want a car crash, and neither Germany nor any of the other countries, because it will be detrimental for everyone. And they will try to prevent it and try to offer whatever is possible. But they are, of course, the single market is not going to be broken up.
Okay.
And there will be some things that are just not possible. And the Irish question might just still lead us to a car crash. And the citizenship question still might lead us to a car crash. We are inches away from it.
Hmm.
And I think that is acutely felt in Brussels, and they will try to prevent it with all means achievable. I do not think that is acutely enough felt in Downing Street.
Okay, Philip?
I'm going to push the boat out. I'm going to, just from a German point of view, my hunch, I could be wrong, my hunch is that the Grand Coalition deal will get voted down by the members, and so we have a little German government crisis as well. We're going to have Merkel reluctantly agreeing to do a minority government, but that's going to really mean that Germany is not actually going to do much. There's not going to be many impulses coming from Germany on Brexit at all. Perhaps in 8 months' time we'll be looking at another German election. So Germany be wrapped up in itself, and Brexit will sort of be a little noise in the distance.
Do what it does. Okay, fair enough. Well, that's about it for this week. My thanks to Stephanie, Imke and Philip for joining me today. Please do subscribe and review on all your favourite podcatchers. Join the discussion on Twitter. You just need to search for Guardian Podcasts. If you want to get in touch, it's Brexit Podcast. That's all one word, brexitpodcast@theguardian.com. Till next week then, I'm John Henley. The producer was Stuart Silver. This was Brexit Means, and thank you very much for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.